You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
Joining us from up in Tauranga, we have Greg Newbold on the line. Greg has just came out with a new memoir called Dream Dealer, which investigates his life from beginning till now. Greg has had a pretty fascinating life. I'll say that much. I think I mentioned earlier that Greg went to prison in the 70s for dealing heroin. That's not the sum total of his life, but it is a pretty foundational experience, it seems. So we'll be talking all about that and a great deal of his life beforehand. Good morning to you, Greg. How are we?
Morning, Zach. Good.
Nice. How are the things in the mighty Tauranga?
Oh, today it's a bit overcast, but it's a wonderful place to live.
Sorry to interrupt you. I heard that the Tauranga Council had a bit of a... They were at loggerheads for quite a long time. Is that situation resolved?
They had a what?
They were at loggerheads. They were feuding for quite a while, I heard. Is the council... Is it sussed out now, or is it still shit?
Yeah, they were under statutory management for a while, and they're it's difficult to understand some of their decisions, but, you know, I mean, they sold off the marina at fire sale prices, and I can't figure them out sometimes. Had to sell a big parking building they built. They had to sell it for $2.
No way.
Because they screwed up the engineer.
$2? The engineer.
Yeah, they had to sell it for $2.
Oh, my gosh.
Because it was unstable and it couldn't be used for anything.
That's
so they sold it for $2 and pulled it down and built something else.
Sometimes councils work in mysterious ways, huh?
Yeah.
Well, this is exciting that you've got this new autobiography out, this new book, Dream Dealer. My first question is a pretty simple and kind of dumb question, but how do you remember anything? Like, did you do any interviews for this in case your memory was patchy on a certain time period?
Well, I've got some records. I've got some diary records, and I've also got photographic records and publishing records and also my CV. So I was able to get dates and so on pretty well accurate. I was able to be quite specific about times and places and things like that.
Did you have to do a lot of introspective thought onto, like, what you actually felt like at a certain time? Because, I mean, there's stuff here from your childhood that is just so vivid.
Yeah. Well, I've got a pretty clear memory of my early years, actually. I've got, I can remember a lot, and I've thought about it a lot as well.
Well, there's lots to think of. Let's start at the start. Your parents both met in the Radio Corps during World War II, which I thought was quite fascinating. What was their job?
Mum was a clerical worker, and Dad was, I think, assembling radios.
Whoa.
But then he got interested in photography and came to Auckland to start up a reprographics firm with Neville Newcomb Limited. So that was really the beginning of his career.
So cool that your dad was assembling radios, man. I mean, that's just...
He started off... He left school at 15 and started working in Wellington for a pound a week. Now, that's $2 a week, which wasn't even enough to pay for his board.
That's nuts.
Times were pretty tough in those days.
It is funny looking back at you talking about how much your rent was in the 70s, being like, you know, $7 a week or something, and just how nuts the dollar has really spiraled out since then. Like, I'm paying $160 for rent these days.
Well, my budget when I was at university was $20 a week, and that included rent.
Yeah,
you know,
that's nuts.
But then I got a boarding allowance, and I was able to increase my budget to $25 a week, which was luxury for me. But mind you, I mean, I lived really, really Spartan life. I mean, I didn't have a bed. My bed was on the floor. I lived with some other students. I never bought any new clothes. All I ever ate was lamb neck chops, cabbage and potatoes.
And porridge
as well. And that was it. You know, it was pretty, it was an easy life, but it was good. You know, I mean, I didn't care. I was young. I was more interested in women.
Oh, man. You know the extreme violence that your parents endured when they were children.
Yeah.
For instance, there was a time you mentioned that your father was beaten by his teacher, so he hid from school in a ditch. Then when he was discovered, your granddad beat your father up, and then he beat up the schoolmaster for beating up your dad, which is insane. But they didn't repeat the process for you and your siblings. I want to know, why do you think that was?
Oh, my dad was a very intelligent guy and insightful guy, you know, and he didn't, both him and mum was the same because she got thrashed by her mother as well,
yeah,
you know, and they both decided together that they weren't going to subject us to the violence that they'd experienced when they were children. And, you know, quite often people who are brought up in violent household become violent towards their own kids.
That's usually the trend, yeah.
That's, you know, it's an ongoing process. But mum and dad were wise enough to see that was a crappy way to bring kids up. And and also mum was involved in the early play centre movement. You know, mum was reading up on the new post-war ideas about child rearing, and she read copies. She wanted to be a perfect mother, and she was a good mother too when I was young.
It was really hard reading your childhood sort of juxtaposed from growing up in nature. You know, you lived just down the road from a bush reserve, having a bunch of close friends and being in the bush all the time, and then your mother started drinking and it became a massive problem that ultimately saw the separation of your parents. What effect did her, like, drinking have on you in your childhood, do you think? And, like, how do you process that? When did you realize that, oh, this is actually horrible? I went through a lot with that.
I didn't know. I wasn't really too worried about it, actually.
Really?
This wasn't affected. You know, I'm a fairly resilient kind of a bloke. And when I was, even when I was young, it didn't affect me at all, really. It was a bit of a nuisance, but that's all. I wasn't emotionally affected by it to any extent. At that stage, you know, I was entering my I was around about 10, I suppose. And by that stage, I was fairly independent. Me and Andrew Duckett, who had parents who were similar, and he was my next door neighbour, we just lived in our own lives. We just lived in our own bubble, you know. And what was happening with the parents was really peripheral to that. I wasn't emotionally affected at all.
That's nuts. You got a heart of stone there, Greg. Oh my goodness. Oh, there's a real pivotal moment in the book when you leave high school. You know, it's crazy reading that they tried to expel you for premarital relations, and then they enforced really strict hair-length regulations on you, and that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, what was the vibe of Rangitoto College? You know, why was it so strict? Why did it have to uphold such an image?
Well, that wasn't really unusual in the early 1960s. The contraceptive pill had only just been approved. That was in 1960. And it was highly controversial. You know, people thought that the contraceptive pill would lead to promiscuity. And there's an incident I record in the book where even the local chemist refused to sell me condoms at the age of 16 because he thought 16 was too young to have sex. So it was the liberal sexual ideas of the 70s hadn't struck New Zealand at that time. So it wasn't that unusual to be I was illegally expelled, but, you know, I mean, that expulsion really had to go through Wellington, but they didn't. They just did it off their own bat.
That's absolutely.
And I didn't know any different.
Yeah.
So they suspended me. You know.
That's nuts. There's a real.
But the main thing really was the religious thing. You know, the real thing was an underhanded thing where the Board of Trustees, Richardson, the chairman of the board of trustees belonged to the same church as the girl that I was having sex with, and her parents didn't want her going to hell by having premarital sex with me, and I wasn't interested in religion. So that's the way they got they got it done. They just played it, they dealt their cards from the bottom of the deck, you know.
Yeah, they played dirty. Not good. There's a real sense that you're a prankster in this book, from reading about, you know, you shanghaiing your neighbours to clipping your boss's coats together when you're in the forestry service. I think it speaks to a sort of a broader anti-authority streak that you've had in your life, and I guess that manifested really, really crazily in the 70s. But where does that come from?
Well, I've always been good at thinking for myself, and I'm also quite self-confident. In fact, I'm overconfident a lot of the time, and that's come back and slapped me in the face as well. But I've always resented being told what to do by people who I think don't know what they're talking about, and that was particularly so when I was young. I was very much a independent thinker, and that's one reason Mum's drinking didn't worry me. You know, I was living in my own world, and I thought I had everything sorted out, and I wasn't worried about it. Mm. I've always been quite confident, and I've also been pretty good at seeing bullshit and seeing through it, and I don't suffer that kind of thing very well.
Mm. It's, I think, also, I guess, easier to rebel against the, you know, the very doctrinal ways of the 60s, like you mentioned with Rangitoto College, you know, having to be under all these religious and social norms that were very, very harshly enforced, whereas nowadays there's not as much of that, you know.
Yeah, I'm not a conformist, you know. I can see through crap, and I think for myself, and I've always been able to do that. To see through other people's bullshit and think my own path, think through and follow my own path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally get that sense. It's funny, you were in Australia in 1970 on a summer from uni one year. And while you're on uni break, you were in Australia doing a labouring job, and you went to a Woodstock-esque music festival there full of hippies, weed and music. And just out of curiosity, I wanted to know who played at that music festival. Do you remember any of the bands?
The guys I went to Australia with, Nick Miller, Alan Bevan, who was killed in 11, and Mike McLaughlin. That we were, the four of us went together, and we all went off to this music festival. It was at Wallachia, which was a like Woodstock. You know, that those big concerts suddenly became popular after Woodstock, and Australia had this big one.
Do you remember any of the bands who played at that festival?
Pardon?
Do you remember any of the bands that played at that festival?
No, I don't remember any of the bands at all. They wouldn't have been big bands. We were just mainly smoking dope and trying to pick up women. And walking around with no clothes on.
Sounds like the 70s.
Everyone was naked, you know. It was bloody funny. Everyone was naked and stoned and dropping acid trips and wandering about in the days.
Oh, man,
there was bloody piles of, there was piles of shit everywhere. You know, there wasn't enough toilets for people. There were piles of shit with toilet paper.
Oh my god,
it was really messy. Eh?
You know, it didn't sound too bad with the drugs and the people walking around naked, and now there's piles of shit everywhere. It doesn't sound very good.
Yeah.
Oh man. But before going to jail for dealing heroin, you went to a youth detention centre for growing weed. Now, these military-style boot camps are intended to give a short, sharp shock to young first offenders. But 70% of the people who went through went on to reoffend. Now, this government, this current national government, tried its luck with a similar scheme, and it as well failed. Why haven't we learned our lesson here, given that we've tried these military boot camps before and they just don't work?
History repeats itself, you know. Mm. And policymakers, a lot of policymakers don't have, well, especially politicians, they don't have a very good handle on history. At the moment, they're trying to do it again, and they won't. I've got no confidence at all that these new boot camps are going to achieve anything at all. But they're a political thing, You know. They're a political thing. They're a vote catcher, and that's why people jump on the bandwagon with these things. But the boot camps have never worked anywhere in the world history. History is very clear on that.
It is. It is. And at the detention centre, you were at, if you reoffended after your first offence, you got sent to the borstal that was right next to it. Did you ever see much of what that borstal was like?
Oh yeah. The borstals were, you know, sentences of 0 to 2 years.
Yeah.
There was one at Invercargill. There was one on Waikerea. And those borstals, they had a huge failure rate. And that's why they were abolished as well. Mm. They were based on the American reformatory system. And you got a sense of 0 to 2 at that time. Originally it was 0 to 3. And you could be released at any time by the parole board. So most first offenders would serve maybe 12 months. And then if you went back to Borstal, you'd serve 18 months, probably something like that.
Mm.
But you could be released by the parole board. And they were very violent places, you know. There lots of violence, not only violence among inmates, but also violence from the prison officers who ran them.
But given that your detention centre was right next to the Waikerea borstal, I'm just curious. Did you happen to see much of what it was like from a first hand perspective?
No, we didn't see them at all. We were completely separated from the borstal boys.
Mm.
But the Borstal boys were a tough crew. And of course, having been at, when I went to prison later on, I got 7.5 years, and I was in maximum security prison. Nearly all of the guys there had been through Borstal, so they told us, you know, we talked about that a lot, about what Borstal was like.
Mm.
And then I studied it, of course, in one of my books, The Problem of Prisons. It's got a big section on the borstals.
It's a fascinating world. Your foray into drug dealing was quite fascinating. You were bored with student life and academic success, so you chased adventure, and you met a guy and soon started selling weed together. And then from there, you used his contacts to get into the hard drug world. And it's strange that you tried heroin before selling it and then using it a lot when you became a dealer. Was the phrase, "don't get high on your own supply," not invented yet?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh. Well, it's just fascinating. When you became a heroin dealer, you were trying it, and there's that famous phrase, "don't get high on your own supply." Was that not was that not common parlance back then?
No. All the dealers were using heroin that I knew.
Mm.
In jail, there was a guy called Brian Wareham who got 11 years with heroin, selling heroin, but he wasn't using. But that was pretty rare. It was pretty rare for people to sell heroin who weren't using it. I don't think Terry Clark was using heroin, though.
True.
Terry Clark would have been using him, but he smoked a bit of dope and dropped acid.
Mm.
But he didn't use hammer. But
he was a big
most people use. Well, I mean, I'm talking about, when you think about it, I was really a low-level dealer. You know, I was really a bottom-level dealer. And the guys who were doing the big time stuff, yeah, I mean, I think some of them weren't using smack, but all the street level dealers like me, we were all using it.
Mm, mm. You just mentioned Terry Clark there, who was sort of a notorious drug leader, I guess you could say. And you met him in prison, like firsthand, right?
Yeah.
And he was trying to scout you for his mob just as you got snapped up by the police. That's nuts.
Yeah. Terry was an interesting character. He was very cold, a very cold guy, but I got on pretty well with him. I quite liked him. Him and Ray Brunel, they were good guys. We struck up a friendship which was very quick and and enjoyed each other's company. Mm. And that was in Mount Eden and when we were on remand together.
Mm. Do you think
if he came up and introduced himself to me, you know?
Mm. Do you think if you joined his operation that there was a risk he might have eliminated you? Because there's, you know, you mentioned in that section about going to prison that he, when he left prison, he killed a whole lot of people in his crew.
Yeah, he did. He killed a lot of people. But he killed people who were narking on him, you know.
Mm, okay. So
Doug Wilson was actually narked on him, you know. Doug got a big habit he was a good bloke too, Doug, but he got a big habit, and him and his wife were both executed on Terry's orders.
Nuts.
And that was Doug was the guy who I knew quite well and was he was my link with Terry.
Mm. Mm. When you came out of prison, did you expect that you'd just jump back into like your life? Did you expect that to happen? Or, like, what was your expectation when you left prison and what did it feel like when you actually did?
I was sort of, I was on a balance. I was equivocal, you know. On the one hand, I had this big pull to go back into crime because I was fully criminalised by that stage and fully committed to the criminal ethic. And I could easily have gone back into dealing. But I was very lucky that I had people like Bill Hodge and Bernie Brown behind me, backing me, and they gave me opportunities, such as getting reviving my scholarship, which had lapsed while I was in prison, and Bill got me out running marathons and that pushed me in the other direction. But I was really on a knife edge. I could have gone either way, so I was lucky to have people supporting me and backing me when I got out, and pushed me onto the academic path, so that I could, you know, write my PhD. I had a first class honours with my MA, which I finished when I was in prison. Mm. I wrote the whole thing while I was in prison, and then got a first and a scholarship, and then I was able to do my PhD with the help of Bernie Brown and Bill Hodge at Auckland University and the law school at Auckland University.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you took the right path after prison, man. You learned your lesson, and that's the best thing anyone can do. And you know,
yeah.
That's all we can do. Thank you so much for coming on the program today, Greg. I really appreciate you taking your time out of your day. Just one more thing. Do you have any final thoughts, words or opinions to leave our listeners with?
No, I'll just say that I if I had my life over again, I wouldn't do it any different, you know. Going to prison really, really made me, it expanded my horizons and gave me an opportunity to understand the way other people think, the way other people live, and it was really, really an enlightening experience.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that you took that lesson from it, man. All the best for the future and all the best for the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you. That was Greg Newbold, folks, Professor of Criminology. We're talking to Greg about his new memoir, Dream Dealer, From Prisoner to Professor, The Extraordinary Life of New Zealand's Leading Criminologist. You can find that at paperplus.co.nz. When I think of this book...
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcasts.